Tyler's Long One.
Well, this is a very special Tyler's Long One. Special for a couple of reasons, actually. Not least of all, of course, the subject of the interview, Derek Bell, MBE. Still the most successful Englishman at Le Mans with 5 wins under his belt. But also because it actually never started out as a Tyler's Long One. It was meant to be a short 10 or 12 minute segment for Midweek Motorsport, but as you'll hear, it was very different from that. Apologies for the background noise. We were sitting in the driver's room at Top Gear Live at London's XL Exhibition Centre, but I think you'll agree it doesn't take anything away from what the great man has to say.
Derek, first of all, welcome back to the UK, and you don't seem to spend too much time over here in Blighty nowadays.
No, well, you know, most of my young family is in the States now, and I have the business over there with the Bentley dealerships and things, and so I spend time there, quite logically, but of course, home is home, and England is my home, and I love coming back and adore it, and the sad thing is that I don't get to see all the guys, and you, as we said yesterday, how often have we sat down and had a chat? You know, and it's, we see each other at Le Mans for a fleeting glance and off for somewhere
Weird
else.
Wave through a crowd somewhere.
Yeah, so it's been great to sit on a couch now and again and have a natter.
It's been amazingly to think back that it's been now 40 years since you were involved in the making of Steve McQueen's movie Le Mans, which was never a big hit at the time, but has since become a seminal motor racing film, perhaps the motor racing film, particularly for sports cars. Do you still think back to that, and do you still have good memories of that?
Yes, I'm reminded of it perpetually, and I think because of the Gulf situation, the famous 917 that happened to be only the second car I ever drove in sports cars, so, you know, that keeps coming back. Everybody keeps thrusting photographs in front of me, sign this, sign that, you know, over the months, and of course, you know, you can't fail but just go back to the movie all the time. And then to have this, we had a tribute dinner two or three nights ago to the making, or should I say the release of the movie in 1971, and of course Chad McQueen was over as well, who I've got to know pretty well since that period. You know, you can't fail but think about the McQueen movie, actually.
The thing that most people don't understand about that even in movie terms, that took a long time to film. It wasn't just a case of turning up for a couple of weeks, getting some footage of the cars. It was months and months and months of closing roads and dealing with the locals. It was a real nightmare.
Yeah, again, you know, it's like everything one seems to get involved in life. You only ever do it once. And I went into that, you know, just purely as a driver in a Ferrari, in fact, 512S. And you get in there and you realise the enormity of it. And they built a village, you know, they shut the roads around the city whenever we wanted to. And we'd have 3 mile sections of the track to film. And they just shut it off. And if you wanted to get out of your house, sorry, son, the guardrail's up, you can't do it. And of course, we tied everything up with the actual footage. We filmed 22 hours of film during the 24-hour race with cars with a car in the race and other stuff. So they tried to tie it up and make it as real to the real-life movie, and they did do that. And now you look back on it, you realise, I mean, apart from some of the dialogue, which wasn't that great anyway, but how can you make a dialogue about a 24-hour film? There's no romance, really. It's a matter of getting on, getting out of the car, being exhausted, have a drink and get back in again.
I mean, you look at it now, and you look at something like Truth in 24, which was made for Audi North America a few years ago. It's actually not that different. I know it wasn't a documentary when it was made in 1970 and released in 71, but it has a documentary edge about it. You could almost believe that that was real because the attention to detail was so great. And that came from McQueen, didn't it?
Yeah, exactly. I'm so glad you said that, because it's how often do you get an actor who's actually wants to be, whose passion is car racing? And they can't, like today, they couldn't do it again today, although they'd love to, because you can't go and ask Matt Damon if you'd like, we want you to be a racing driver. So he goes and studies Lewis Hamilton, let's say, for 3 months of what his habits are. But there's still no passion there, because the next month or last month he was doing a film about the lawyer.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, but Steve had this passion. And he had this, and he bothered to ask us. He'd say, what do you think about it? Would this work? You know, is this real what I'm doing? I don't want to go over the top. I mean, everything was done with such detail. And people might say, oh, well, it wasn't quite. It was damn good. You couldn't do better than they did.
And they were breaking ground in technology in those days as well, Derek, because let's not forget, this was big, heavy film cameras. These weren't miniature cameras like they have on the inside the helmet of Formula One drivers. These were big cameras with reels of film on, that moving arm on the side of the GT40. Spider that they built specially for that. And you drove that camera car as well at one stage, didn't you?
No, actually, I did. Very briefly as I can make it, we actually stuck a rig on the back of the 917. And to do the overtake by McQueen in car number 20 of the Ferrari number 8 or 7, whichever it was. And we had this frame that stuck out of the side at the back of the car, right across, so we measured it so that it had a trip on it that hit the back of the Ferrari as I slid by 4 inches apart. The trip had a camera out there, bloody great camera. And as I literally touched the back of the Ferrari, it would release the magnet and the arm would swing around with this massive camera on and swing around behind me. And then as I went by him, the camera lens would logically pick up the side of the car, having picked up the rear. And of course, as we did it, of course, as it flunked around doing a practice at 100 odd mile an hour, of course, what happened is the car, it swung around with such a weight out the back, and so far back, it was like 5 feet back, it tipped the front of the car up in the air, and I swerved off towards the guardrail. Fortunately, you know, by hitting the brakes, it dropped it back on the road, and I got grip, so back to props and put some more weight, so we put these massive lead weights on the front. But it came out quite well, and they show it in that you can see it in the movie, but it's... everything was groundbreaking, to be honest. And I mean, there were so many stories you could tell about it. You'd go on for hours.
Is the story about, I think it was you and someone else, charging down side by side down towards the old White House and encountering a cameraman lying in the middle of the road. Is that true?
Absolutely.
And if it's so, finish that story, because that's quite remarkable as well.
Yeah. Well, we've been filming all day, and Steve was actually directing on that corner. John Sturgis, the main director, was down at the Ford chicane. We were coming all the way from Arnage. It was a long way, down through the White House, as it still exists, but, you know, where the houses are, we don't run it anymore.
Yeah, not through the new Porsche curves.
We came down and through this cutting, as we used to call it, tap the brakes, and about 150, 140 go right and left through these houses. Just three or four houses, but you had to be pretty precise. There was no runoff. I mean, there was a 3-foot grass virgin guardrail. The track had got a bit wider over the years, so they'd made an infill with asphalt to make the track that bit wider so we could run off, because we were running on the grass. And every time we came through, boom, round the house, Siffert was behind me, I was in the Ferrari, Siffert was in Steve's car. Literally, every time we came round, the cameraman was, with this bloody great camera, was in a different place. And on this one lap, by this time, of course, we're getting, you know, the tyres are warm, and we're getting, Joe and I want to enjoy it. I mean, the whole reason we did it was for fun. And so we came storming down, flick right, flick left, went through, Joe right up my tail, because the 917 was always a little quicker, and he was quicker than me. And we went through absolutely on the link. And there in the road is a camera, a big camera, on the white line, dotted line in the middle of the road with a cameraman behind it. So we, and so I thought, gee, and I, obviously I was fine because I could see it. Poor old Joe was behind. He was looking to overtake me and pull out and have an overtake. And as he went to pull out to overtake me, he suddenly saw the cameraman lying there. So anyway, we get down to the Ford chicane, and Joe leaps out of the car, and he comes around and he says, "We have to do something about this. This is terrible." So John Sturgis said, "What is it?" He said, "There's a cameraman lying in the middle of the road." So John gets on his radio, you know, says, "Come on, Steve." So Steve puddles up on his 400 Husky and sort of stops up beside us, you know, swings his leg off in the cool way. And so John says, "Steve," he said, blah, 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 blah. And Joe is raving on. So John said, "Who the hell allowed this?" So Steve said, "I did." So he said, "But you've got no right to put the cameraman in the road. Who did you put in the road?" He said, "It was me." Because he dare not put the cameraman in. He did it because that's the shot he wanted.
So that is the true story. Absolutely. That was McQueen lying in the road with the camera.
Yeah, I was a little close to him. So I noticed, Steve. No, honestly.
When you look back at the movie now, Derek, do you still look back with affection? And do you think it's stood the test of time?
I think it's matured. And I think it's become a really hate the word iconic, really, but I think it's getting up there with some of the great movies. And it seems to be one we often show at Christmas here, because there's nothing nasty about it. It's a fairly simple story, and the colours and the cars are just so dramatic.
Well, I remember watching it. It would have been in about the mid-70s. We had a film club at school, and we watched it in the school hall on those horrible old moulded orange chairs that you used to have, and watched it, and... It blew my mind. I mean, for a lad from the northeast in his early to mid-teens there, it was something. The cars looked like something from another planet. And I think, even looking back at it now, the drama of it, particularly for people who are interested in the sport, I think it does reflect the drama. And every year that I go to Le Mans, you can't help thinking about that movie, because if you change some of the haircuts and some of the cars in the campsites, it's not much different now in 2011 or 2012.
Exactly. All the cars are there. They're just different colours. Mm. They make wonderful noises. Mm. There's a massive audience. And it has that Le Mans atmosphere, and the clock is much the same as it used to be.
Absolutely.
And you can't help but go back to it, and you just see the clock ticking down and the flag being unfurled as they drop it for the start. I mean, it was very dramatic, and I think it really all came out in the film.
Now, what are you doing with yourself now? We've seen you over the last few years being involved with Bentley. You mentioned the Bentley dealers. You're still doing some work for them?
Yes, I still work with them sort of all over the world. And I'm part owner of a Bentley dealership along with Bentley, Jaguar, Land Rover, Aston Martin, Rolls-Royce, Maserati and Porsche in Naples, Florida. Hence, I don't get back here too often. I only own a very small portion of it, but it's intriguing to me. And I think having been in cars all my life, you realize what the hell do you want to go off and try and be anything else? One thing I'm quite good at is talking about cars. And they like having me there. And we're just actually opening in Nashville, Tennessee on the 17th of December. We should be good with the Bentley dealership.
Well, so. I know a decent. You've got a half decent potential client there in Dario Franchitti, obviously, because he does like his motors as well.
That's right. So we'll drag him down there, I'm sure.
Yeah, sounds like a good one. Yes. The other thing that's come back around recently, apart from talking about the Le Mans movie, as we tend to do from time to time, is that your book's back out again, being reprinted. It went out of print for a little while, disgracefully, in my mind. But this is a book that you and Alan Henry did a little while ago.
Actually, I'll correct you, it isn't. It's totally different to the first book.
Oh, is it?
Not one picture in there was in the first book.
Ah, right.
No, they did talk about a reprint, and then I said, I don't know, a reprint. People seem to want what's happened since 1987.
Right.
So a lot of the stuff in there is what happened really after I went to America.
Right.
I don't think it's worthy of making a book about it, but somebody does. So we put it all together, and Alan Henry worked with me, or I worked with him. And we came up with what we've got, and it's a coffee table book. And I just think it's got lots of great pictures. And racing, I love it, because racing people look at it and go, oh, look at that car. Gosh, I remember that car. Well, that was before my time, and it makes me feel very old.
Yeah, I also like looking at it and going, look at the hairstyles, actually, which is good.
Yes, it is. But, you know, when you look at it, how often do you look at somebody's career that might have been in racing for 40-odd years? Mm. And you look at it, and you look at, and I always sort of appreciate all the people that helped me, and I hope that in the book, you know, Tom Wheatcroft and the Colonel, my father, and even going to Ferrari and Enzo's wanting me to race for him, and all I went through, and Steve O'Rourke of the Pink Floyd, who helped me so massively, and then you realize that how big a part Le Mans played, 26 races at Le Mans. And it's funny, you sort of become part of these eras, and I think hopefully we bring it out in the book.
Actually, I need to ask you about Enzo Ferrari, because there's not an awful lot of people that I can sit down and talk to now who met the great man. And there's a lot of mythology about Enzo Ferrari and what the company was like at that time. Mm. What do you remember of it, and what was the overarching atmosphere that you got when you walked in to talk to that man?
You just can't believe it. You cannot.
And there's a smile on the face of Derek Bell now, ladies and gentlemen.
You can't, because you cannot. You cannot go back to what it was like. I mean, I met Enzo Ferrari. I'd been invited, got the call. I had three calls. I had one. I'd been supposedly testing for Lotus because Jimmy Clark had died that year. And I went testing at Silverstone. That's beside the point. And then I got a call from Cooper and then from Ferrari, all in the matter of 3 weeks. And I'm going, bloody hell, you know. And of course, I had no managers, nobody to advise me. I mean, it was just me as a farm boy thinking, bloody hell, where do I do? So I went and had a test drive at Monza. And with Ferraris, and somehow I got the drive, and I went to Modena that night. I stayed in Modena. I went to Maranello the next morning, and there was nobody there. The place was deserted, and I walked around with this secretary guy. He showed me around, and it was so impressive to watch, to see. And again, I could labour on about it for ages, but ultimately, I said to him, you know, why is there no people here? He said, today is a national holiday. But once I was there for about 6 months, I realized that a national holiday meant they were on strike. So and that we had lots of national holidays. So well, it wasn't only Ferrari, it was the whole motoring industry. So anyway, we're walking down. I'll never forget it. I was walking down in the actual assembly area, and on either side of me at shoulder height were all these 2-foot-75 GTB4s, 2+2 GTCs, the convertibles, the whole lot in different colors. And the guys would have been bolting it up. And there are all these cars. And as far as I could see, like down the exhibition hall here, and as you look down, all you could see were these cars either side. And round the corner comes the old man, with his raincoat over his shoulder and the tinted glasses and the white hair, just as I'd read about him. And he walks towards me, and you know, he never was, you know, like, "Hello, nice to meet you." It was very much sort of shaking the hand, very polite, very correct. And we talked, and he said, "Okay, let's go and have lunch." So we went to Cavallino and had lunch. And that, I mean, and I went out with him lots of times. I mean, they used to say, "Tonight you'll go out to dinner with El Comandatore," and I go, "Bucker, I wanted to go out with my mates, in Mike Parks and everybody," you know. So, and the old man would come and pick me up in a 2+2 at my hotel, drive up outside. "Mr. Ferrari's here." They'd open the door, I'd get in. We'd walk into restaurants together, and he'd have his arm around me to guide me in. And I mean, I remember Shell wrote a piece, and it said, "The Golden Boy at Maranello," which was me. Now, I didn't ever become really, I didn't really make any money for him. I didn't really, wasn't really golden, but it was certainly, it could have been a golden era for me. But unfortunately, the cars weren't quite right, and I don't think I should have ever been world champion, but I think I was quite reasonably good at that time.
Well, has there ever been, or will there ever be, the size of the personality drove that company on? I mean, is there anything comparable nowadays with Enzo?
There is nothing. In a way, it gets back to the McQueen making the movie. Yeah. Yeah, it's the same sort of passion. And I mean, to meet that man, I mean, I went back. I knew him a lot. I mean, in the mornings, I would go in, and my wife at that time was very ill, and literally very ill. And in a way, I shouldn't have signed for Ferrari. The last thing she needed was her husband racing bloody Formula One with all the dramas that went on. And I remember every morning I'd walk into the factory, and he'd summon me into his office, and he would say, "How is your wife today?" You know, I'd say, "I don't know, because it's 9 o'clock in Italy and 8 o'clock in England. I haven't phoned the hospital yet." So he'd pick up the phone, you know, and get his secretary to phone up and see how she was. Mm-hmm. He was a very family-minded man. I mean, I went, Chris Amon and I, after my first sort of 3/4 of a year with him, you knew if you were going to get a drive with him the next year, if you got summoned to lunch with him the day after the Italian Grand Prix, because the Grand Prix used to be on Saturday. You do the race on the Saturday, which I didn't finish. I qualified 6th, 7th or something, and something went wrong with a piston or something during the race. And but I got summoned to his house, and so Chris and I drove down an Alfa 1750. We drove down to Rimini, Bellaria dell'Adriatico, which is where he had his little house. He had a really shabby sort of little beach house.
Really?
It was pitch black, dark inside, very dull. And his wife, Senora Lara, was there, who I only met on that one occasion. And Chris and I had lunch on it. Can you? I mean, when you reflect on it, to sit with you and me and Chris with the old man Ferrari and his wife having lunch, which she had prepared,
in a beach house.
In a beach house. I mean, can you believe that? And it wasn't exactly glamorous. It wasn't like, you know, they'd have Ron Dennis or, you know, any of the guys they'd have on the rocks overlooking the Côte d'Azur. It was bloody well on Rimini Beach. Mm-hmm. You know, and but at that time you didn't expect anymore, because nobody else gave you that. I mean, Ken Tyrrell never gave the impression he lived in a palace, nor did Jack Brabham. You know, and it was a totally different impression. People did racing then to be racing, to win races. They weren't worried about the PR value until sponsorship really came in.
But Ferrari, even at that time, Notari, truly was much more of a business. I mean, the famous comment about the British teams being the garagistes.
Yeah.
You know, he did look at it as a business, and it was there to sell his road cars. But I get from what you're saying that some of the comments I've heard down the years about the Commendatore being more business-minded than racing-minded probably wasn't true, that he still had that passion, that fever, that heart that beat for the racing.
Yeah, I don't know, maybe it's my mentality, but I mean, I have to say, when I left, I was a little bit disappointed, because I didn't really want to leave, but there was no cars. They pulled out a racing in the middle of the year in a Formula One and said, "That's it, we're not racing anymore." So I was out, we were all out. But at the time, I never got any push from Ferrari. I mean, he said to me one day, "I have a new car for you for this weekend," when I raced in Sicily. And I was terribly excited to have a new Formula 2 car. And, I mean, he really bothered to look after me, but I never heard any of this backbiting, fighting stuff that did apparently went on. I mean, you wouldn't get Niki Lauda now or Nigel Mansell to talk favourably about him. You might in 15 years' time, when they're my age or whatever. But I was a bit bitter and twisted when I left, because it actually ruined my career. I mean, John Wyer said to me, you know, the Gulf John Wyer, when I went to the GT, when Mr. Ferrari wouldn't release me to drive for GT40 at Le Mans in 68. He said, "Ferrari will ruin your career, dear boy." And he wasn't right at all. He ruined my Formula One career. But in fact, I would never have missed being with Ferrari for the world now.
Was it just a question of bad timing for you? Do you wish that you'd gone to Ferrari either earlier or later in a different time, if you could have shifted those years that you were with them, because unfortunately you were there at a time where their cars weren't great, simple as that.
But the strange thing about it was, I mean, that very first Grand, I drove at the Gold Cup at Oulton Park, and I was like on the third row, and there was Chris, I think, on the front row. Chris would always be up on the front row doing really, really well. Yeah. I mean, it was astonishing, but we couldn't win damn races. But it would let you down. I mean, I could, I'm sure, I was, you know, running sixth and starting sixth or seventh in the Italian Grand Prix. I should have been in the top four places. Mm. And I mean, I was good in single seaters. I mean, you know, in Formula Two, I was European champ, a bit second to Regazzoni, but whatever. But I mean, great. We had some great bloody races. And there's no reason I shouldn't have gone well in Formula One. Mm. I was never a Jackie Stewart or a Formula One champion, but I think I could have been and won a few races. Mm. And if the car was right, you're going to win. You've seen that over the years anyway. But I was always disappointed that I went to Ferrari too soon. But you see, I didn't have a manager in those days. None of us, very few.
Few did, yeah.
Jackie Stewart's probably the only one that had any form of management. And we just went where our heart told us to go. And you think, God, Ferrari, if I don't accept it, I'm going to be out. I'm never going to go anywhere else. Yeah. And of course, I snatched at it. And I realised, I was saying this the other day, I realised that probably 7 or 8 years later, I was a far better driver.
Yes.
Because I matured. I mean, I know it's
probably a far more mature person as well, and could have handled
absolutely.
It differently.
But I mean, I've only been racing. I was only in my fourth season when I got signed up for Ferrari, and I'd never done karts. So I went to Ferrari in my fourth year of sitting in a race car, and I look and I think, blimey, if I'd done that now, I would have had a lot of experience in karts beforehand. So it'd probably be my 10th year of competition when I went there, so I'd have a different mental outlook and be more mature. And I regret that in many ways, because I know when I drove late 70s, early 80s in sports car, that I was bloody quick.
Yeah.
You know.
The difference between open wheel cars, formula cars in those days and sports cars, was it much different to what it is now? Because nowadays we look at things like the Audis and the Peugeots, even going back to 2003, the Bentleys, and they pretty much look like a formula car with a set of fenders on it. Was the transition to sports cars that you had, was it more difficult in those days? Or was it just the fact that everybody drove everything, you just got on with it?
You just drove everything, and that's it. If you looked at a Siffert, you know, he drove Formula 2, Formula 1 and sports car. You looked at Rodriguez, you looked at Jimmy Clark, you looked at all of them. They all did everything they could do, because they wanted to race. There was a passion to race. You go to Goodwood, let's say, for the Easter Monday meeting, and Jimmy would be in the Cortina race, in a Lotus 30 in the sports car race, in the Formula 1 in the Formula 1 race. Admitted they're only half an hour races, but you know, it was just the versatility, and I think the guys today have lost out from not having that versatility. I admire them and I envy them their sort of one-tracked way they go racing. But I tell you, to have had the experience, that they wouldn't be able to write a book like mine, because they've only been in go-karts, Formula 3, Formula 2, Formula 1. You know what I'm saying?
Now that's a good point. Then would you trade what you have had for a couple of seasons with a top Formula 1 team now?
No, I'd like to have had a top Formula One team then.
Yes.
I don't know, but I wouldn't miss it. I wouldn't turn it down. It's like somebody said, I said, I never won the Nürburgring 1000 Ks on the old track, or I never won Sebring officially at the 12 hours, and I would trade that for something, because I'd just love to win two of the greatest races that I never did. But I don't miss. I'd rather have had the period I had than the modern period, in a way, because of that. And the fact of knowing, now there's so much inbiting, there's so much commercialism. I mean, literally, we get out of a car after practice or qualifying on a Saturday like they will today. We used to get out of the car, but before we got into practice, we'd say, what time's practice over? 3:30? Okay, see you at the golf club at 5. And we'd go and play 9 holes. You know, I mean, that was the way we did it, you know, and we wouldn't go on the piss at night or anything like that. We'd go out and have a good time, but we're still serious about our driving. But there wasn't this sudden computers till midnight. It wasn't a lifelong job.
No.
It didn't wear us out. I mean, you remember talking to David Coulthard about it. He said, it's just so wonderful when we get in a car, because we can actually do our own thing.
And to a certain extent, then everything else is switched off. You're focused on doing your job.
Yeah, that's right. And I don't know that having said that, having done my career and what they do now, I'm going, blimey, it restricted my life. My whole, and I sometimes you go, wouldn't it be hard to have your whole life dictated by Formula One? But I don't know. I love my life of being able to go off and race in Australia and do the Tasman Series, stay there for 7 weekends over the new year. You know what I mean? And come back, you know, and go off and do the Argentine Series, a Temporada in Formula 2 that was 5 races. I mean, bloody marvellous. Then come back. Oh, Europe. Mm. Let's go back to Europe.
It seems mad that I've been talking to you for 20-odd minutes and we haven't really talked about your Le Mans career, but I'll come on to that in a moment because I do want to touch on your European Formula 2 career. Mm. We talked a little bit about it the other day, and people forget this about you, because obviously you had so much success at Le Mans, because you are the most successful British driver at Le Mans with your 5 wins, that they forget that you had a prodigious and very fast rise to fame, as you've mentioned, in Formula Cars. And Formula 2 and European Formula 2 was an integral part of that, Derek.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, that's what it gets me going a bit now about today. And, you know, young kids say to me, what can we, you know, where do I go? What series do I run in? And I go, I honestly don't know. I don't know where you start. And if you're coming from America, where the heck do they come over to go to? When we were in it, when Tiff and I were in it, and James Hunt was in it, and lots of drivers, a hell of a lot, that made it, we were in Formula 3. You did Formula 4 if you're lucky. They didn't have that when I started. But Formula 3, Formula 2, Formula 1. You know exactly the route up, the graduation. You knew how you're going to get to the top school. And that doesn't happen these days. And these guys are wandering around, do I go Mazda? Do I go BMW? What formula do I go in to get there? And not many people can actually tell you what that way to go is today.
And also it dilutes the talent pool, as we were talking about the other day. How do you compare somebody who's doing Renault 3.5 with somebody who's doing GP2? Mm. I mean, we're involved in the sport, and I find it difficult. Those F2 days, I mean, you raced F2 at Rouen-les-Arts, that classic track that was used for the French Grand Prix up until 1969-68. You raced Formula 2 there.
The last year.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was amazing. When I think about it, I raced Formula 3 and Formula 2 there. But I remember John Watson, he broke his bloody arm there, didn't he? Was it Formula 3? He crashed out on one of those long curves. And I remember there was a crash with Bob Wallach and another guy. And, I mean, we never knew about it. The other guy was dead. Mm. Bob went up a tree, and the other guy, we didn't know till like the next week that somebody had been killed in the race. I mean, that's what racing was like in those days.
Well, there's places there where you could go off the road and you can see a bit of a tree, but actually the bottom of the tree is 100 foot further down the side. It was a road race for Formula Cars.
Yeah, but the thing is, because it was so fast, we were inclined to run together a lot. You know what I mean? Because you know there weren't as many corners as you'd think. But I remember we started in Formula 2, and Jochen Rindt and I, for some reason, were on the back of the grid. Something gone wrong in practice or qualifying. I remember I thought, at least I'm at the back with a star, you know. So, and I remember just working our way through. Jack Brabham was in that race. I have a feeling he might have won it. That was the great thing about Formula 2, is the Formula 1 drivers would come down and drive at our level. Mm. And that was a great way for us to show our ability. It would never happen these days, but that was the way that people say, God, do you see that? That guy, you know, sort of pushed, it was on the front of the grid next to Jackie Stewart, you know, and the other side it was Beltoise, and you could see people's ability, and we're all in such similar cars. It was either a Brabham or a Lotus, from what I recollect, and we all had FVA Cosworth engines, and of course some teams were, you know, spent more money on their testing and that sort of thing, but I mean it was an incredible formula, and I think that's a great loss to the young people today. However, there are probably so many more young people out there today trying to work their way through. That, of course, you could probably never have those strict formulas. But I'm sure Tiff at some point would probably back me up. I mean, there was an Italian Formula 3 championship. Mm-hmm. There was a French Formula 3 championship. There was a British Formula 3 championship. And a German championship. And a Scandinavian championship. Mm. And then, so they'd all have their championships. And a few of them, the better ones, would filter out. And we'd all meet at Monaco. And there'd be 40 cars qualifying at Monaco in heats to get into the Formula 3 race.
It's a bit like the Formula Ford Festival, if you like.
That's so, right,
so
yes.
Super Bowl, but, if you like, for our American listeners at Formula 3.
Yeah, and of course, Monaco was the jewel in the crown in single-seaters. And so all the people like Ken Tyrrell, they used to always use Ken as an example of people picking up young kids. All the Formula One team owners would come to watch our race, you see, on the Saturday, because they could see where the talent was. The future talent, they don't know where the hell to go these
days. I think it's a massive problem. I mean, the other thing, of course, that's changed, and thank God it's changed for the better, looking at Rubens Barrichello on the Brazilian Grand Prix this weekend celebrating 10 years of Formula 1, that in your day would have been unheard of.
Yeah, I can't say I know anybody that did Formula 1 for 10 years, because the chances of you surviving that long were very slight. And I mean, I'm not being maudlin about it, but I remember at a dinner earlier this year, Jackie Stewart said, in our day, he said 3 out of 5 drivers didn't make it. Mm. That's pretty
good. Yes, he didn't mean weren't successful. No. He meant didn't live.
Yeah. And that's pretty hideous statistic, to be honest. And we lived through it. I mean, my first year at Porsche in the 917, in my welcome to sports cars, I'd done three races the year before in a Ferrari, and there I was in the 917 team. And, you know, Joseph and Pedro Rodriguez both died, two of my teammates.
In case you haven't worked out, we're talking to Derek Bell, MBE, here. And, well, we've sort of stayed away from sports cars a little bit, but when you start talking about the 917 Porsches, that's something that you can't... I can't leave that lie for a little while there, Derek. Just what sort of a car was that? Because you look at that car now, and it scares the living daylights out of me to sit in it and walk around it when it's standing still.
Yeah.
So it was a genuine 240, 250 mile an hour car at Le Mans, and it looks to have been made out of the tube that should be making shopping trolleys.
Well, I think it was. It was a lighter weight tube than made shopping trolleys, but it was made by Porsche.
Mm.
And, of course, they were bloody brilliant, and they made sure the car was good. And, I mean, if you talk to the engineers today, they would say every race that we finished, they'd sort of put their hands together and go, wow, we were lucky. Mm. And I was very fortunate. Well, actually, all of us were lucky that they actually never broke while we were in them. I mean, the only bad accident was John Wolfe at Le Mans, and he shouldn't have driven the car anyway because he was an amateur, really. And it wasn't an amateur's car.
In what way was it not an amateur's car?
Because it was so hideously dangerous or undrivable at the time. Nobody would drive it. I mean, they did, but they sort of... I remember Frank Gardner was offered to drive it, and he said, I'm not driving that thing.
Why? Because it was unstable?
It was unstable. Yeah, very unstable. Fortunately for me, and of course people say to me, of course you drove that lethal Porsche at 917, and I didn't. I drove it the last year when all the lads had sorted it out. I was just lucky I was there at the right time.
Mm.
So having said you were there at the wrong time in some occasions, I was there at the right time, and I had the best year that anybody could wish for in their opening year at Porsche.
Mm.
And the car never let us... I mean, we had a couple of engine problems, but again, we didn't have electronic gear shifts. I mean, we had to shift gear, and they ended up giving you problems, or you missed a gear. I mean, if you missed it by 200 revs, it blew up. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty critical that you were very, very conservative about how you drove it.
Talking of sports cars, of course, brings us back to Le Mans, which is where we started this conversation, and your five victories there, 20-odd starts in the race. What was it about that race that you clicked with? Because you did. There was no doubt about it. You got it, and you got it pretty much immediately, didn't you?
Mm. Yeah, it was never a race I had an ambition to win. I wanted to be a Grand Prix driver. Well, yeah, I mean, Formula One, it was for all of us. You know, for Le Mans, yeah, okay. What's that about? And you read the results, but I never followed it. And then suddenly I get hoiked in to do it. Well, I guess when John Wire asked me to drive GT40, I took an interest, which actually was only in my third year. So I suppose, in reality, I guess it was a major part early on, but it didn't figure out of that in my brain that way. And Ferrari wouldn't release me from my contract, so that was understandable. But I did test at Thruxton when the Thruxton track was being built in the GT40. And I then went to Le Mans in 1970 in the 512. But I think the reason Le Mans is a track is I always like long circuits.
Mm.
And I love high-speed corners. I love the precision of a high-speed corner and the precision you have to have and the neatness you have to have taking the car through. You can't be in big handfuls of opposite lock at 160. You can't. You know, the Mulsanne kink, for example, you're taking it 246 in the 917, let's say, or 235 in the 962. But, I mean, of course, the 962 is a piece of cake because we had slight ground effect.
Yeah.
Hence, it was slower. But the 917, you had to be spot on, and you came with that little... 246, you arrived there pretty bloody quickly, and literally you come over the brown, you flick it right. And, I mean, you just turned in, and the car went through. I mean, it was every lap, it was... I think I forget just how critical it was you were right.
But it was fingertips.
It was fingertip. But you had to be that precise. In fact, I watched some footage the other day of us in the 962s, in car stuff going through, which in the car 956 you've probably seen some of it. And literally, as we came up, well, me and this particular drive up the corner, if you actually didn't see the road, you wouldn't know I'd adjusted the wheel.
Oh, really?
And if you look at it closely, my hand doesn't do that. It doesn't turn it, because I'm moving it like that anyway all the time, because you're balancing it.
Yeah.
And next thing is we're around the corner. I went, do you know, I didn't notice me even turn the wheel. Because at that speed, it's such a... instead of doing one right, one left to balance it, it's two right and one back to the left, and that's turned it, you know, at that speed. And you don't think of that until you see it. I would never have said that until I saw it. I studied it one day when it was being shown at some event the other week.
What was your best victory at Le Mans? What's the one that gave you the most pleasure?
Do you know, The most pleasure was finishing third with Justin and Andy Wallace.
I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
Yeah, that was my best one, yeah. in my own mind, to be honest.
Martin Brundle's going to do the race with his son Alex next year. What advice would you give to him? Because obviously you did race there with Justin.
Well, I don't have to, because Martin's done it and he's won it. So he knows how to win it. And as John Wyatt said to me one day, Derek, you and Jackie know how to win it. Off you go. I hadn't won it at that point.
Is it different racing with your son?
I think so, yeah. He'll find it tricky. But I think once... He's not as though he's in single-seaters. And I watched Justin trying to qualify at Indy. I didn't enjoy that. But I think when you're with him, you can help guide him. And I think you know he's in a safe car and you're driving the car. It's when it's wet in the dark that Martin will find it tricky.
Derek, thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you. I loved it. Thanks.
This programme is a Radio Show Limited production. For more, go to www.radiolemon.com. Radio Show Limited. We talk to the world.